This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The self-help industry is huge. The advice is out there plentiful. But what actually makes us happy? A professor of psychology has looked at the research and has plenty to share on what works, what doesn't, and on how much control we have over our own happiness. This hour, On Point, the science of happiness. Joining me now from Santa Monica, California, is Sonia Lubomirsky, professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She's an associate editor of the Journal of Positive Psychology and author of the new book, The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. Hello, Sonia.
Hello, it's great to be here.
I went through your name about six times, and there you go. Lubomirsky, there you go.
It means, you know, it means love and peace, so it's very appropriate
Excellent.
For a positive psychologist.
Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much. You are not a life coach. You're not a self-help guru. You're a research scientist. Tell us what you set out to do in this book.
That's right. The book is, I think, unique in the sense that there's, as you know, there's lots of self-help books out there about happiness, but I think I'm the first author of a self-help sort of how to be happy book that actually does research on how to make people sustainably happier. And we, in my laboratory, we do what are called interventions, which are experiments where we test different strategies for how to make people happier.
And you actually received a grant. It was a 5-year grant, right, from the National Institutes of Mental Health to do your work beyond
That's right.
what you just mentioned. What did you study?
That's right. So Ken Shelton and I have been doing this for, I guess, 4 years now. The question that we asked is whether it's even possible to become a happier person and sort of sustain that level of happiness, because there was a lot of pessimism in the field about that. And so we developed a model and concluded that it is possible, sort of despite the fact that happiness is in part genetically determined, and despite the fact that our life situations or life circumstances actually have a minimal influence on how happy we are, still a great sort of proportion of happiness is under our control, sort of by the ways that we think and the ways that we act. So that's what we test in our studies.
So set the table for our conversation with a working definition of happiness. How do you define it for your research?
Sure. Researchers define happiness as having two components. And the first component is basically the experience of frequent positive emotions. There are, of course, some negative emotions, but more positive emotions. And the second component is a sense that your life is good, that you're progressing towards your life goals, that you're sort of satisfied with how your life is going. So it's sort of that combination of positive emotion and a sense of satisfaction with your life.
So you mentioned that it is scientifically possible to be a happier person. And in your book, you have a pie graph that describes what determines happiness. And I'd like you to describe that for us.
Sure. Sort of the pie chart is kind of a way to illustrate what are the main determinants of happiness. And so about 50% of the pie is genetic. So this comes from research with twins, and the research shows that people are born with what's called a happiness set point, which is a characteristic kind of level or baseline that we tend to revert to, you know, even after ups and downs. So that's about 50% of people's happiness levels is explained by the genetically determined set point. About 10%, I should say these numbers aren't really set in stone, they're estimates. So about 10% is our life circumstances, so whether we're attractive, whether we're wealthy, whether we're healthy, whether we're married. And people are usually surprised because they think that should be higher. But that still leaves 40% of our happiness kind of under our control, sort of room for improvement.
So when does that set point, you mentioned the happiness set point, mm-hmm. when does that settle? How does that, by what age do we know how happy we're going to be?
That's a good question. We don't really know the answer to that question. I mean, there's certainly lots of research showing that happiness is pretty stable over the life course. So, you know, you have kind of this baseline that you tend to revert to. And, you know, most people, when they're asked, you know, are you a happy person? Are you sort of a moderately happy, very happy, unhappy? I've never had anyone say, I have no idea. You know, people have a sense of what that set point is. But we also have developed some measures that can sort of help you know what your set point is.
So does that set point change over time for better or for worse, or it just always is?
Well, the way that I interpret the literature is that set point always is. It's sort of something that's coded in your genes, just like you're coded for blue eyes or brown eyes. But that doesn't mean that your level of happiness cannot be changed. And I often make the analogy with weight. You know, a lot of researchers think that there's a set point for weight that we're born, but that doesn't mean that we're doomed to be overweight or underweight, because we can sort of, through our actions and efforts, we can change that level. And same thing for happiness. Mm-hmm.
So you put the hard science to work and you analyze the patterns of happy people's lives. Tell us what mm-hmm. you found.
Sure. Well, the first about 10 years of my research, I was looking at sort of why are some people happier than others, and I found that happier people are more grateful, they're more forgiving, they're less likely to compare themselves with others, they're less likely to dwell on little things, they live more in the present moment, they follow goals. And so the question really was, well, if an unhappy person kind of follows what happy people do, are they going to become happier? And I didn't really know the answer to that question until I started doing sort of these interventions or experiments. And so in our experiments, we actually tell people, okay, you know, once a week or three times a week, we want you to express gratitude, or we want you to try to practice optimism or do acts of kindness. And then we follow people over time to see if those strategies work, and even more important, to see how they work and why they work.
And what did you find over time?
And so we're finding that these strategies are working to make people happier on average. But it also matters very much sort of how much effort you put into. Again, kind of like with weight loss or fitness, you have to put effort into it. It also matters how you do them. So, for example, we had one study where we had people count their blessings or sort of write down what they're grateful for either three times a week or once a week. And we found that people who did it once a week got happier, but the people who did it three times a week did not change in their happiness levels. And we think that it has something to do with the fact that if you do it too often, you kind of are trying to think of things to be grateful for, and that could really backfire. It could become more of a chore. So you have to sort of attend to sort of how often you do it, you know, with whom, you know, this, all these factors are important. Mm.
So from your research, based on what you just said, what do people believe makes them happy, and what actually does make them happy? So do they think that one thing makes them happy and it really doesn't?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of call this sort of, you know, if, you know, when I will have something, I will be happy. A lot of people think, you know, when I have that boyfriend, that new job, when I move to the new city that I want to live in, if I have more money, I'll be happy. And I think many cases people are wrong about that. That's sort of a myth about happiness. And the reason that it's a myth is that there's a phenomenon called hedonic adaptation. And what that means is that we tend to get used to or get accustomed to almost anything positive that happens in our lives. So we get a salary raise and we're really happy at first, but then we just get used to it and we want more. And this even happens with marriage. There's a really nice study that showed that people have a huge happiness boost when they get married, but on average that boost only lasts for 2 years. Hmm. And then we sort of revert back to our former baseline. So these sort of life circumstances do make us happy, but not for as long as we think.
You say anything, the need for anything positive, the constant mm-hmm. hunger, you say in your book, for new acquisitions as well, and mm-hmm. experiences in the same way.
That's right. I mean, we always want more. And, you know, you could argue that it's evolutionarily adaptive to sort of always want more, always strive for more. And that's how we sort of accomplish things. But we need to sort of keep that in mind and really try to enjoy the process. So I have a chapter in my book about following goals, because it turns out that happy people have meaningful lifelong goals that they pursue. But you really need to sort of enjoy the process, because once you achieve that goal, whether it's getting promoted or whatever it is, then you just sort of want something else. You sort of replace it with another goal.
You mentioned in marriage the honeymoon lasting on the happiness mm-hmm. scale about 2 years. How long does it take, generally speaking, for people to snap back to their baseline level of happiness after, well, you know, buying a new car or upgrading the kitchen or whatever?
You know, that's a great question. We don't really know, because I don't know any studies that have looked at that. But, you know, I bought a new car last year, a Prius, which I really loved. And I think it lasted maybe 6 months. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the acquisition, like a new house versus a new, you know, iPhone. I mean, it's going to have be different for different people. But what I argue is that there's ways that, that we can kind of thwart or slow down that adaptation with sort of by actively really trying to appreciate what we have, maybe using it in a variety of ways, because things that are dynamic, that are changing, that are full of surprises, we're less likely to adapt to. So when you get the new gadget, you know, try to use it in different ways, share it with other people. So there are ways that we can kind of slow down that adaptation.
Can we be too happy? Sonia, is there a point when you know, not thinking critically enough is a bad thing if we're always looking on the bright side?
Sure, sure. There's definitely situations where happiness may not be conducive or functional. So I have a paper with two colleagues where we talk about this, that if you're sort of monitoring, if your job is to monitor a nuclear power plant or to be an accountant, sometimes sort of being too happy may not be conducive. And there's a very nice study that was published by Shige Oishi and Ed Diener and colleagues where they found that people who are sort of extremely happy, sort of a 10 of out of 10, do a little bit worse than sort of the 8s out of 10s and things like being productive and at work and making money. So there are situations that being too happy is not functional.
So what I hear you just saying then is on a scale of 1 to 10, the happiness scale, if you will, the best place to be is about, what did you say, an 8?
An 8, yeah. But I should say that's only for certain things. So for social relationships, actually the 10s are doing the best because they're the most sociable, they're the most friendly, the best liked. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the domain.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the research on happiness. We're speaking this hour with Sonia Lubomirsky, professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and author of the new book, The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. We have lots of callers, and I want to get to them. So let's go first to June, who's on the phone from Newton, Massachusetts. June, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
The thing that will make me the happiest is to get rid of this consumerism.
Too much stuff everywhere, huh?
Too much stuff. Yeah. iPhone, iPod, yeah. I this, I that, and digital stuff. And I'm completely back down from the 20th century into the 18th.
Has it taken you a while, June, to learn that? June, has it taken you a while to learn that, or has that come with age, or...?
Yes, I got everything set up exactly the way I wanted it when I retired, and now it's all gone. It's all obsolete.
Very good. Thanks for your call, June. It's a good question, Sonia. Let me ask you what you found in your research about materialism and money. Does it make people happy?
You know, I absolutely agree with June's comment. Materialism does not make people happy. In fact, materialists are less happy for a variety of reasons. Once they get what they want, they just, that boost lasts for 5 minutes, and they want something else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely. Money, does make us happy for a time, but then we want more. And it's terrible. This is terrible for the environment. It's a bad thing for a lot of reasons that people are just constantly sort of buying more stuff. They're moving into a new house, then they're renovating it all the time because they just get used to what they have.
Mm. Back to the phones and Pauline, who's in Buffalo, New York. Pauline, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
My question revolves around a definition of happiness as opposed to the notion of contentment. I've often heard that we in American culture today are obsessed with a notion of self-improvement and seeking happiness, and that in more traditional cultures, people seem to be value more contentment, which means maybe acceptance of traditional way of life, let's say an arranged marriage vis-a-vis our own, marriage for love, maybe close family relations in these traditional cultures, as opposed to what the last caller was talking about, material accumulation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how scientifically you can separate these two notions of happiness and contentment.
It's a great question, Pauline. Thank you so much. Sonia, what do you think? Happiness versus contentment? Is this an American
Sure.
issue, American problem?
You know, cultures definitely differ in their definitions of happiness. I myself have done some research on this. And the way I see it is that contentment is part of the definition of happiness that we were talking before. It's that sort of life satisfaction part. And people define it differently. So some people are content with, you know, accepting sort of what they have, which is maybe not very much. And some people are content with sort of bigger things. When I went to across cultures and looked at sort of how people define happiness, as I said, there are many differences. Americans are more likely to talk about sort of career, fun, family, money. I went to Russia, which is where I'm from, and there people talked about взаимопонимание, which means mutual understanding among people, or a world of peace and beauty. Those are the things that sort of would make them happy, spiritual salvation. So people kind of define happiness differently. They think different things would make them happy, but I think the desire to be happy or content, sort of depending how you define it, is fairly universal.
Mm. In your book, you detail 12 scientifically tested activities that people can use to increase their level of happiness. You mentioned a few. I know that they're on the list. What are some of the more important ones, the more significant ones that you found in your research?
Sure. I'm not sure if I can kind of rank them on sort of which are more important, because it depends on the person. In fact, one of the themes of my book is that you need to sort of tailor the strategies for yourself. And so for some people, being grateful is going to be the most important. For other people, it's going to be something else. And so I actually have a diagnostic test that helps you determine what will work best for you. But you know, following significant life goals is important. Being optimistic, sort of positive thinking is important. Flow, which is kind of being engaged and absorbed in what you do, coping well with stress and trauma. You know, bad things happen to all of us, and so we need to learn how to cope. Being forgiving. So, but again, it sort of depends on the person. For some people, it's going to be one thing. For someone else, it's going to be something else.
You mentioned that for the most part, people fail, generally speaking, because they do certain things. You mentioned people who ruminate. Rumination is a huge barrier to happiness.
That's right. I used to do research on rumination, and it's very powerful. You know, when you're sort of in the thick and the tangle of it, that you just sort of want to dwell and kind of figure out what's wrong with you about your problems. But what happens is when you're feeling negative, when you're feeling sad or angry or anxious, rumination is just going to make you feel worse, and it sort of compounds the problems. And so, if you need to kind of think about what to do about a problem, you want to wait until you're sort of in a more neutral or positive mood. But yeah, a lot of us ruminate, and women are more likely to ruminate than men.
Ah, interesting. Across the board.
Yes.
People also fail at boosting happiness because you say they choose strategies that don't fit with their strengths and lifestyles.
That's right. And sort of what I was talking about earlier, that we need to sort of choose what fits us. And so I developed a kind of a scale or test that you can take to figure that out. And because, you know, you pick up a self-help book and it'll say, count your blessings and you'll be happy. And you know, personally, counting blessings doesn't really work for me. You know, I kind of hate to admit that because it's a very powerful strategy. But, you know, when you look at that, when you read that, it makes you feel like a failure because you think, well, I don't want to do that. And so you just need to choose. For some people, it's physical exercise. For other people, it's meditation. For other people, it's trying to live more in the present moment, sort of whatever sort of fits your lifestyle and your interests and your goals.
I have lots of callers on the line, so I want to get them in here. And Carolina is on the line now from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Carolina, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, did you do any research with people who suffer from serious mental illness, such as depression or bipolar? And did you find that the strategies that may work for people that do not suffer from mental illness would be different, and were they as effective? And something related, I was wondering if you have heard anything by the name of cognitive behavioral therapy, because it sounds like there are some similarities between that and some of the strategies that you suggested as far as staying in the moment or maintaining a gratitude diary. And the other thing I thought
I think we've lost her. Carolina, thank you so much for your call. Sonia, first question, the chemical depression issue, mental illness. What did your research show about that?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I actually used to think that if you're depressed or anxious or have a mental illness, that you need to kind of get rid of that illness first before you can try a happiness strategy. But there are now studies showing that actually these kind of strategies that I talk about are extremely effective with depressed people. One of my favorite studies done by Marty Seligman had severely depressed people and ask them, think about three good things that happened to you that day. And so every day they sort of thought about three good things, which is not very easy to do when you're very depressed. And 90% of them got less depressed. Hmm. And so these very simple strategies can work for the most sort of severely depressed individuals, I think that's important to know.
And what about cognitive therapy? I think that was Carolina's second point.
Sure. And yes, of course, cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the most, if not the most effective treatments, therapies for depression. And it's true that a lot of the strategies that I talk about have things in common with that therapy, because it has to do with, a lot of the strategies have to do with changing how you think about yourself and about your world, about trying to be more optimistic, trying to be more grateful for what you have. That it certainly has a lot in common with cognitive behavioral therapy.
I'm curious, are people who are predisposed to be unhappy, those people, you know, we all know them who seem down or who have other more serious, you know, issues, are they doomed to stay that way?
I don't think so. Certainly, the research shows that there is such a thing as a predisposition to unhappiness. So I talked about that genetically determined set point. But again, I think with effort, anyone can become happier. Now, they may not be able to go from a 1 to a 10. There's probably a limit, a constraint at how far they can go. But it's just going to take effort. I mean, we all know people who are naturally happy, just like we know people who are naturally skinny, and they don't have to try hard, right? They just kind of, these sort of strategies come easily to them. But if they don't come easily to you, you need to sort of put a lot of effort into it, perhaps every day for the rest of your life. And now the good news is that some of those sort of practices are going to turn into habits, and so they'll be easier over time.
I'd like to bring another voice now into our conversation. Joining us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Eric Wilson. He's a professor of English at Wake Forest University and author of the new book, Against Happiness, In Praise of Melancholy. Welcome to you, Eric.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
So you celebrate melancholy, if you will. What reservations do you have about this conversation and about happiness?
Well, my book explores a rather long tradition in the Western world that suggests that melancholy often shows us parts of ourselves that we would never explore otherwise, and also that when we're melancholy, we often come up with some of our best ideas. We're often creative when we suffer melancholy because we yearn for a deeper, richer connection to the world around us. Mm.
So the merits of sadness is sort of a sweetness in melancholy in many ways, not the least of which is a creative streak that may come?
Well, one of the heroes of mine that I explore in detail in my book is the early 19th century British poet John Keats, who in his great poem, Ode on Melancholy, suggests that we can only experience the world's beauty when we feel sorrow. And he gives the example of beholding, say, a flower, and experiencing the beauty of that flower only when we know it's going to decay, that it's transient, that it's very fragile and tender. So right at that moment, we feel a strange connection of sorrow, beauty, but also a kind of exuberance at experiencing the world's beauty. Put another way, if one were told he had, say, a year to live, that would, of course, be very sad, but it might bring the world to life and make it more vital and interesting than it would otherwise have been.
I see a caller who's in Boston who agrees with you. Glenn is on the line. Glenn, welcome.
Hi. How are you everyone doing?
Thank you. What do you have to say?
Well, it's interesting. I just had get into the car. My son is in the hospital, and I'm on my way to the office, and I just finished reading Thomas More's book, Care of the Soul, and he speaks quite a bit to the idea of, what your other guest there is speaking to in terms of melancholy, but the other side of it, the shadow of the soul, and how much as Westerners we look at, this idea of trying to get rid of feeling bad, and trying to somehow extricate this sadness out of our life because we want to be happy, as opposed to looking into it and seeing the beauty within. And I just wanted to know what your what your other guest, your primary guest there, what she had to say with respect to that in her book.
Glenn, thank you. Good luck to your son. Sonia, what's your response?
Sure. I have a couple of responses to that. The first one is that no positive psychology researcher has ever sort of claimed that we should make people, everyone happy, and that we should make happy people happy all the time. The happiest people experience negative emotions. They experience anxiety, anger, resentment, regret, sadness. And those emotions are functional and adaptive, and there are definitely situations when you need to experience those emotions. But, you know, what Eric Wilson was talking about, sadness or melancholy kind of spurring creativity, there's absolutely no scientific evidence for that. All the studies, and there are many, many studies in this field, show that it's actually happier people who are more creative than the sad people. So certainly there's anecdotal evidence that there's some cases of brilliant writers or artists that are severely depressed or unhappy, but the scientific evidence just doesn't hold up.
Mm. Professor Wilson, you want to respond?
Well, I would say I'm coming from a tradition in the humanities that often assumes that empirical research, though valuable, often doesn't sound the deepest mysteries of life, mysteries that have often been referred to as the soul or spirit. So I think in my book I'm just exploring the possibility that what Carl Jung suggests might be true, that when we are in a kind of darkness and feeling neurosis, that's a form of knowledge, a form of knowing. So What I would say is I'm not really trying to marshal scientific evidence. I'm trying to just explore mysteries of life that philosophers from Plato to the present have kind of delved into. And again, that is the idea that a full-hearted life is a kind of rich conversation between joy and sorrow.
I'm curious where you fall on the happiness scale, Professor Wilson.
I would say I'm probably pushing, if I hit a 5, I'm probably 4 to 5. I do have a rather melancholy disposition, and in some ways my book is my own effort to explore my own character and try to find virtue in a condition that I've struggled with most of my life.
Struggle with. So yeah. You'd like to be happier. You'd like to put some of the practices in Sonia's book to work.
Well, yes and no. My sense is that when we feel dissatisfied, when we feel incomplete, when we have a spiritual hunger, a longing, we often feel most alive. So for me, what I want out of life is a sort of exuberance, almost an ecstasy, that often comes from a mixture of pain and pleasure, a feeling that when we don't know the answers, a feeling that when we are suffering fertile doubt or rich confusion, that is precisely when we are most alive, when we are incomplete, when we are contemplative.
Hmm. Professor Wilson says his happiness scale ranks about a 5. Sonia Lyubomirsky, what's your ranking?
I think I'm more of a 7 or 8.
And
I'm a generally happy person.
Is that good enough for you, or would you like to be 9
yeah,
or 10?
You know, it is good. Yeah, it is good enough for me. But I still try to use some of the strategies that I talk about in the book. So there's sort of things that I, for example, you know, living more in the present moment. I'd like to do that more. You know, when I'm with my kids, you know, I'd like to really live in the present moment and not worry about, you know, the orthodontist appointment the next day. So I still kind of try to take my own medicine.
We are talking about the science of happiness with Sonia Lyubomirsky, author of the new book, The How of Happiness, The Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. And we've also been speaking with Professor Eric Wilson from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, professor of English at Wake Forest University and author of the new book, Against Happiness in Praise of Melancholy. Professor Wilson, thanks so much for your thoughts and for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed being on the show.
Appreciate it. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about how to be happier based on what the research on happiness tells us. Sonia Lyubomirsky, I'm wondering, what was most striking to you after all these years of research on happiness? Was there something that especially surprised you?
Well, I guess the most surprising thing is the research that shows that kids don't make people as happy as they think they would, that people with kids actually are less happy. And I still don't really understand why the research is finding that. I think there's maybe we're not using the right methodology about that, because that is definitely the most surprising finding.
Are they asking moms after they've been up all night, or are they asking them after 20 years of life?
You know, they ask them at different kids of different ages. You know, it's a really robust finding, and the more kids that people have, the less happy they are. And, you know, someone who has little kids, and I think they're the greatest thing in my life. It's really hard for me to believe that.
Yeah.
And so I hope someone is going to, you know, develop a methodology or a paradigm that studies this question and sort of gets at the answer.
What do you make of it, given your own personal experience and then the research?
I don't know. I mean, of course, these studies, it's confounded because people who choose to have kids are different from people who choose or cannot have kids. So it's only a correlational finding, right? You can't sort of do an experiment where you make some people have kids and some people not. So there might be something about that. I think kids give you a sense of sort of meaning in life. Maybe some of the things that Eric Wilson is talking about, kind of this exuberance and meaning in life that our measures just aren't quite capturing. Mm. And so, you know, once we develop the right measures, maybe we'll show. I hope to show that kids actually do make people happy.
Mm. Back to the lines now. Cammie is on the phone from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Cammie. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
It's curious that you were just talking about infertility because. Or having kids and not making them happier, because I have dealt with infertility and been trying for 6 years to have children, and trying to have kids is such a strong desire. It is so hard to be happy when what you think is going to change your life, what maybe you've dreamed about for your entire life, is so impossible to achieve.
Right.
And I'm wondering what you think about that, whether it's possible to find happiness in this process. And that might kind of spill over to the process of like when people have a life-threatening illness and when you really can't seem to have the control over your life that you think you ought to have. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Good questions, Cammie. Thanks so much and good luck to you. Sonia?
Yeah, you know, I think control actually is a really big factor in happiness. And you know, I was talking to you before about how people adapt to almost anything positive in their lives. Now, they don't adapt to almost anything negative. There's certain negative things that people don't adapt to. So infertility or some disabilities, illnesses, people do not adapt to because it's very, very difficult. On the other hand, the research shows that we can be resilient. We can sort of use certain strategies to make the best of things, not necessarily to be really happy in the face of sort of tragedy or trauma, but at least sort of to survive, to be resilient. And so for example, being grateful for what you have, you know, so maybe you can't have children, but there's other things in your life that are wonderful, trying to be optimistic. I mean, but I'm the first to say that this is very, very difficult to do, and some people manage it and other people don't.
Lewis is now on the line from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to
Hi,
On Point.
How are you?
Hi, good.
I got two things to say.
Yeah.
One, I'd like to make a very quick comment. I'm a psychiatrist, but I only treated normal people under stress. And they get all the illnesses, about 80%, that bring them into the general practitioner. And how I did it was I would eliminate their stress, but I wanted to make a comment on the kids because that's a very important thing, and then I get into what I wanted to say. I think, yes, kids make us happy. In fact, Napoleon is supposed to have been the happiest when he was with his kids or raising his kids. I found the same thing with myself. I loved every moment of it. Every moment. You have no idea. So what is happening today with the kids is they're sick. They end up with diabetes. They end up with hyperactivity. They end up with a lot of illnesses which are, in a sense, provoked by the environment. And to have sick children or have children that are not rational and act in a crazy manner, that's what's making these people not happy with kids, not that kids themselves don't bring happiness. That's
Lewis, thank you so much for your call. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. Go to another line now. Lisa, also in Virginia Beach. Lisa, welcome to you.
Yes, hi. I'll be brief. I just wanted to touch on spirituality and happiness quotient.
Great.
I was just curious if in the study at all, people that were very spiritual or religious seem to be happier than those who are not.
Terrific question, Lisa. Thank you. Sonia, what do you think? Mm-hmm. What did your research show?
I actually have a section in my book about religion, faith, and spirituality, and it is the case that people who are religious or spiritual are happier than those who are not. Now, the question is why? You know, and researchers really don't know why. They think a huge part of that is sort of the social community that comes, sort of a strong community and friendship and social support that comes from religion. Of course, there may be something to sort of having a sense of meaning in life that comes from believing in something greater than yourself. But,
hope.
Hope. And but again, you can never do an experiment, right? You can't sort of randomly assign some people to practice religion or spirituality and forbid others to do so. So these are only correlational findings. So we don't really know where the sort of which way the causality lies. It could be that being happy makes you more spiritual, or it could be that being spiritual makes you happier, or both.
Catherine now is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to you, Catherine.
Thank you. I'd like to hear your thoughts on motivation, even with the children. I think if your motivation is to define yourself or in selfishly acquiring children or having children, you're not going to get the same satisfaction as if your motivation was to share a life or to expend your life for someone else's. So a motivation for acquiring anything, whether it's greed, jealousy, seems to not bring forth the fruit, whether if your motivation was out of sharing and giving and thankfulness. Hmm. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you, Catherine. Appreciate it. Sonia?
Sure. Again, a good question. I have a chapter on doing acts of kindness or sort of sharing or being generous or sort of doing good for others. And there's a lot of research that is suggesting that people who do acts of kindness, who are generous, who share, are happier. So I think that gets a little bit about what the caller was talking about, the sort of motivation to sort of share with others, sort of to do good for another person. It makes you happier for a variety of reasons. It makes you feel like a good person, but it also there are a lot of social consequences. When you share with others, when you're generous to others, they like you more, they're more likely to reciprocate. You know, you make new friends. So there's a lot of sort of reasons why sort of kindness makes people happy.
You also talk in your book, though, about being forced into a kindness rut for social reasons or otherwise, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, so you could become quite resentful if you, for example, caregivers of ill patients or family members actually have a higher likelihood of being depressed because it's so difficult. And again, you can sort of feel resentful that you're sort of made to do something that you maybe not be equipped to do.
Hmm. Back to the phones now. And John, who's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. John, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a question. I was wondering perhaps if you had run into the scenario where people might do these exercises and perhaps create a world around them that might not match their reality to the point where they might become delusional about their happiness or their well-being. Did you run into any of those cases, and are there either positive, negative, or both effects of some kind of delusion that might come of this?
Good question, John. Thanks. Sonia?
Sure. Good question. Yes, I have not run across that, but I see what you're saying. So, for example, if you're unrealistically optimistic about your life, or you're following goals that are really unattainable, that is not going to make you happy. I talk about that a little bit in the book, that you need to have a sort of a flexible optimism, sort of flexible goals that you need to sometimes replace with goals that are more realistic or more attainable. So that's a good question, and people need to sort of heed that caution.
Mm. Now to Hartford, Connecticut, and Michael, who is on the line. Michael, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Real quickly, is there any research indicating a correlation with ignorance versus bliss?
Is ignorance bliss? Are less aware people happier, Sonia?
You know, I think this is a huge myth about happiness. There's a scene from Annie Hall where Woody Allen comes upon this couple who are very happy, and he says, you know, how can you be so happy? And they say, well, we have nothing interesting to say. We don't have any thoughts. And I think that's really a myth. The research is showing, actually, that happier people are more creative. I mentioned this before in talking to Eric Wilson. They're more creative. They're more innovative. They're more flexible. They're more productive at work and sort of more successful. I think sort of that's a myth. It partly comes from people who are depressed or sort of ruminate a lot. You know, we talked about rumination before, they sort of reflect. But that rumination is not, it's not insightful. It's sort of going in circles. It's going from A to B to A to B to A to B. When you're sad, you're not really likely to kind of gain any kind of insight into your condition.
Are there just certain characteristic or qualities in a person that you can nail right away, like a perfectionist likely will not be as happy as someone who just kind of lets things go?
You know, actually, there's a little bit of research that actually shows that exactly that perfectionism is associated with unhappiness. But it's a correlation, so I don't really know exactly what to make of it.
And what's the breakdown between the nature-nurture aspect of the happiness quotient? Did you study that at all?
Sure. I mean, of course, it's hard to study that, but it's, clearly the answer is that it's both nature and nurture. We already talked about sort of the genetic component of happiness, that clearly part of it is sort of heritable and genetically determined.
50%, you said, 50%.
Yeah, 50% on average. And then part is sort of what we do. What we know very little about is sort of how we're raised, is ways that our parents can raise us. this, is that going to affect our happiness? And it's hard to study. You really need to study with adopted kids, because biological kids share the genes of their parents, and so you can't disentangle nature and nurture in biological families.
More questions from our callers now. In Littleton, Massachusetts, Sonia is on the line. Hi, Sonia, welcome.
Hi, thank you for such a great show. I thank you to your guest as well, Jane.
Good, thank you.
What happens when a happy person lives with an unhappy person? A happy person, as I'm listening to your show, doesn't want to give up, wants to stay in there, wants to caretake, brings up that happy factor by wanting to do the right thing. And yet I wonder if after a while that unhappy person doesn't bring down the whole show. Mm. I'd love to have your answer.
It's a great question, Sonia. Thanks so much for your call, Sonia.
Yeah, very good question. Yes, unhappiness is contagious. I mean, happiness is also contagious, but unhappiness is contagious. And sort of you could argue about what's sort of more powerful, who's going to kind of win. But that is an excellent point. I think that the happy person is going to be more, optimistic, more grit, more appreciative. They're going to sort of work harder at it. Sometimes that work that the happy person is doing is going to make up for sort of the unhappiness of the other person. But I think often that relationship is not going to work. So I don't know much about that. There's not much research on that, but that would be my guess.
The relationship will not work, or it's just that the happier person will become less happy.
That could happen, or that they're going to get frustrated. And again, I really don't know. There's no research on this, but I think it's just a difficult relationship to have. You're going to have to work harder at it.
Anton is now on the line from Albany, New York. Hi, Anton. You're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Good.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. The question that I had was, I understand your point about material possessions as an end to themselves being kind of not the right road to happiness. And I like your example about, people always striving for the bigger house and bigger car and that kind of leading to nothing. My question is what if material possessions is not an end to themselves, but you use the acquisition of material possessions as kind of a tool to achieve bigger things? Like, for example, if you feel like, you need to work on your image and kind of redefining yourself, and that's a goal that you're striving towards, and part of that goal is, working through certain things, and helping yourself appear a little bit different, through material possessions. Can that be a part of a successful technique to increasing your level of happiness, or is that, as long as it's material possessions related, it's not, something that you should strive towards at all?
Anton, thanks. Sonia. Mm-hmm.
Sure. No, it's a really interesting point. Research shows that it's experiences that make us happier than possessions. But possessions can give you experiences, right? So the new car, you might share it with other people, with your friends. You might go on road trips. You might travel in it. You might enjoy music in it. And that will make you a happy person. So, yes, I agree that you can use possessions to achieve happiness, but it's your sort of attitude towards that possession. Is it just you just want it just to as a sign of status, as something to have, or are you actually using it? So my laptop is the only really possession that I love, but that's because it gives me experiences. It allows me to achieve my goals, to do things with it. I'm not just sort of staring at it and saying, oh, how great it is that I have it. So experiences are more important than possessions.
I think what you said in your book was once you have the basic necessities of life met, basic shelter, food, clothes, that everything else is just gravy, and it's the richness of life and the experiences that you get, I think is what you say in your book, that makes you happy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Lindsay is on the line now from Ogdensburg, New York. Lindsay, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you for accepting my call.
Thank you for calling.
I was wondering, as you were talking earlier about how people can surround themselves with a false happiness, that it doesn't actually make you happy. Mm-hmm. If you were trying to help someone that was in need of happiness, and someone that was upset or sad, but you tried to help them, and it felt like them as a false sense of happiness, would it actually make them happier as a person? Would it help them in the long run become a more happy person?
Lindsay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. I guess it depends what you mean by false sense of happiness. I mean, for example, there's some research that shows that if you just act like you're a happy person, you smile, you sort of behave as though you're happy, that is actually going to make you somewhat happier. Not a lot happier, but somewhat happier. And so So I don't know if that's sort of false, but if it begins by being false, but actually leads to real happiness. And one of the reasons for that is when you smile, when you look happy, people respond more positively to you. And that really is a genuine source of happiness. And so, yeah, there's something to that.
So if you act happy, even if you don't feel terribly happy, people respond differently to you and you send out a different vibe about being happy yourself.
Exactly. And so people are going to sort of like you more. You might make new friends by sort of acting happy. Now, I'm not advocating that everyone should go around sort of acting, pretending happy when they're not. But it is sort of one tool in the toolbox of strategies that you can use to be a happier person.
I'm wondering quickly in the last 15 seconds, if you made any major change in your own life, Sonia, after you studied happiness for these many years for your book. Well,
yeah, sure. I mean, I mentioned already that I try to live more in the present moment. Another strategy that I love to use, and it really works for me, is to ask yourself when something bad happens, will this matter in a year? And it's sort of a kind of a coping strategy, because lots of things that are really small make us unhappy. But when you ask yourself, is this going to matter in a year? And you realize it won't, you feel much better.
I love the book, The How of Happiness, a scientific approach to getting the life you want. Sonia Lubomirsky, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. I was very happy to be here.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You ain't seen nothing yet. Best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fun? Best is yet to come. Come the day that you're mine.